Today on Wings.
My name's Loretta Ross, and the reason that I became engaged in reproductive rights work is quite personal.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
This week on Wings, we hear from reproductive rights advocate Loretta Ross, executive director of Sister Song, about her more than 30 years' experience in the reproductive rights movements in the United States. I'm Sarah Olson. I began by asking Ross how she became involved in reproductive rights organizing.
Well, when I was 15, I became pregnant through incest. It was 1968, and it was 5 years before Roe v. Wade, so I was forced to have that child, which is not an easy thing to do, to have a child out of incest. But that was the law of the land at the time. A few years later, I became pregnant again. This time, fortunately, the sex was voluntary, even though the pregnancy was unexpected. But I was living in Washington, D.C. at the time, and I had a legal abortion because in Washington, D.C., they legalized abortion 3 years before Roe v. Wade. So this was in 1970. Then, seeking to prevent future pregnancies, I accepted an intrauterine device called the Dalcon Shield. And it was provided to me at a family planning clinic in Washington, D.C. 3 years later, that Dalcon Shield sterilized me. So in a very short period, I'd had a full-term pregnancy, an abortion, and a sterilization. So about that time, I pretty much figured out that whatever else I was planning on doing with my life, my plumbing kept telling me something differently. And so I became a reproductive rights activist because I thought that what happened to me shouldn't happen to anybody else.
I wanted to ask you a little bit more about the Dalcon Shield because, you know, I know that it's notorious at this point for sterilizing women and not being recalled quickly enough. I'm wondering if, you know, for people who don't know, if you can give a little bit of that history because I think it's kind of fundamental to, you know, the situation that we're facing today.
Well, the Dalcon Shield was manufactured by this Richmond-based company called A.H. Robbins. I'm not quite sure when it was first created, but I know that by the late 1960s, data had developed that this IUD intrauterine device was defective. It was a triangular piece of plastic with the string hanging down from it, and it was inserted right at the front of the cervix as a way to prevent pregnancy. Well, that string hanging down served as a wick for bacteria to enter the cervix and the uterus, and that was its defect. And even though A.H. Robbins had accumulated quite a bit of data showing that this Dalcon Shield was leading to acute pelvic inflammatory disease and then sterilization, they refused to withdraw it from the market. And so once my fallopian tubes ruptured, and my doctor saw what had happened with the Dalcon Shield, he advised me that this was totally unnecessary, that he was able to, as an independent physician, find out information that A.H. Robbins was suppressing about the defects in the Dalcon Shield. So we ended up suing A.H. Robbins, and we made an out-of-court settlement. But I like to think that my case was one of the cases that broke open the class action. Because within a few years of our lawsuit, more than 700,000 women sued A.H. Robbins because of the defects in the Dalcon Shield. And I'd really like to think that that was the end of the story because we settled my lawsuit in 1976. So you'd think 30 years later, that story is over. But unfortunately, it's not. The Dalcon Shield is still being distributed in the third world, in developing countries that don't have the same protective laws around defective products that we have in the United States. And so there's still room for us to fight the dumping of unsafe corporate products on vulnerable populations overseas.
I definitely want to get back to that in a second, but I also wanted to ask you, I believe you also started one of the one of the first, if not the first, rape crisis center in the U.S. Is that correct?
Well, I didn't actually start it. I was the director of the first rape crisis center in the country. I was the third executive director. The D.C. Rape Crisis Center was founded in 1972, and it was the first in America. And I became the executive director in 1979. And so we are proud of the fact that we helped seed an entire movement to end violence against women. We actually wrote a book called How to Start a Rape Crisis Center that sold hundreds of copies around the world because building the movement to end violence against women was a new thing. And we had to do a lot of pioneering work. I mean, we had to write the first protocol for how hospitals should collect evidence for rape victims, how police should respond to a rape victim. Of course, it was very common if a woman had been assaulted for the police to question how she was dressed, whether it was her fault, was she walking in a bad neighborhood, was she hanging out with a bad crowd, always blaming the victim, never blaming the men who committed the violence against women. And so a lot of people don't realize that the movement to end violence against women is a short 33 years old, that we started this movement in my lifetime. And even if we have not stopped violence against women, we've certainly made people aware that it's wrong.
Now, how do you connect the movements against violence against women with the movement for reproductive justice? Where are the intersections there?
Well, first of all, they're connected in women's lives. I mean, you can just look at the very popularized Lacey Peterson story. One time when women are most subject to domestic violence and murder is when they're pregnant. This seems to be a triggering kind of thing that causes men not to seek a lawyer and get a divorce for fear they may end up paying child support, but they take a very extreme measure like murdering the woman and the unborn child. And so there's a very clear connection that seems to happen in the consciousness of men that think that they can kill two for one. But there's a more philosophical connection. We, by keeping the focus on women's lives, we can see that women experience violence at different times in their lives. They have to deal with reproductive health issues at different times in their lives. They have to deal with the lack of housing or the lack of a healthcare system at different times in their lives. So when you keep women in the center of the lens, then the intersections become apparent, because you can't flatten a woman out to just a fertile womb or a woman who's been battered. Well, maybe she was battered, but before she presented at your domestic violence shelter, she probably was experiencing bad housing, the lack of health care, the lack of a living wage, perhaps working at a sub-minimum wage job. All of these things are very important. The thing that I like to talk about in our vision of what a woman's life looks like when it comes to reproductive rights is, think about it if you've ever been pregnant. When you are pregnant, you're not just considering whether or not to terminate that pregnancy or not. That's the least of your problems. You're considering, do I have health care? Do I have a bedroom for that child to sleep in? Will that child have to dodge bullets on the way to school? Oh, well, will my employer let me take off in order to have this baby? Or will they fire me for being pregnant? I mean, these are the kinds of real considerations that real women go through. And then after analyzing all of those factors, they try to make the decision that's best for them and their families. So the decision whether or not to have an abortion is never one that a woman makes out of the context of her lives. But the opponents to abortion always try to portray us as frivolous women who are totally irresponsible, and they're just deciding whether or not they should be able to have an abortion and thus terminate a life. I think that both the people who are opposed to abortion, but I would also add that the pro-choice movement equally do disservices to women when they don't look at the real complications in a woman's life. And if you've ever been pregnant, it's a no-brainer. You know, you thought about all of those things.
Well, that really segues really well into my next question, which is, I wanted to ask you a bit about kind of the development of the movement for reproductive justice. It's a movement that is women of color defined and women of color led. And I wanted to talk about that, but I wanted to first ask you to define it, to talk about what is reproductive justice.
Well, there's a shorthand version of reproductive justice. Reproductive rights married to social justice is reproductive justice. That's the shorthand version. The longer version is the attempts to control the fertility of women of color is directly linked to attempts to control the destinies of our communities. When you're trying to steal our land, you're trying to limit our fertility. When you're trying to exploit our labor, you're trying to breed us so that you can have more laborers. Whatever you're doing, whether it's to increase our fertility or decrease it, you're doing it so that you can control what's happening in our communities. So women of color don't see controlling their bodies as just an individualistic issue. It is about what's happening in my community. Why is this happening? So they can't just say, pro-choice is my body, it's my right. No, it is your body and your body as the template for what's happening towards your community. Now, the term reproductive justice was actually coined in 1994 at a conference in Chicago organized by the Illinois Pro-Choice Alliance. And as usual, a few women of color came to this majority white conference, and we immediately went off and caucused, because that's what women of color always do at these conferences, because we don't have our own spaces where we can organize that many times. So we caucused. And at the time, we were very upset because President Clinton was considering health care reform, but at the same time, he was not talking about covering reproductive rights and health care reform. And we said, well, if we allow this so-called friendly president to get away with not talking about abortion and prenatal care and teen pregnancy and STD prevention and HIV/AIDS in healthcare reform, then he's no worse than anybody else. I mean, he's no better than anybody else that we have to deal with. And so we coined in that meeting the concept of reproductive justice because we felt that the term pro-choice didn't work for us. Why? Because how can you have meaningful choices in a life when so much else is circumscribed? You can't choose whether or not you're going to have a baby when you don't have health care. You can't choose whether or not your baby's going to have a healthy future if you're living in substandard housing. I mean, there's so many issues that affect choice. And so choice as a framework only makes sense to people who actually have choices. People who don't have choices find choice an empty phrase. So we coined the phrase reproductive justice in 1994, and since then we've been popularizing it. We've been using it to describe a human rights approach to looking at reproductive rights that talks about the right to housing, the right to health care, the right to be free from violence as reproductive rights issues, as well as the right to control what happens to your body, but also to control what happens to your community. So that immigrant rights is a reproductive rights issue. Welfare rights is a reproductive rights issue. It connects the dots.
Okay, and how has mainstream feminist movements within the United States picked up the concept of, or how have they not, as the case may be, picked up the concept of reproductive justice and really embraced it as something that's essential to women's movements going forward?
The extent to which the mainstream women's movement has embraced the concept of reproductive justice, I believe, is directly tied to their antecedents, where they come from. We find that the more feminist organizations, the more woman-centered organizations, tend to resonate with that because they see that we're talking about real women, real lives, not just, you know, whether or not they're pregnant or contracepting or those kinds of terms. I find that those organizations whose history is more in the population control movement, that's really focused on limiting population growth and particularly limiting the growth of certain parts of the population, they don't get the concept of reproductive justice. And they really push back and say, well, we don't see how housing is a reproductive rights issue, or we don't see why immigration is a reproductive rights issue. As a matter of fact, we think we should have increased immigration restrictions as a way of controlling the population. And so the term reproductive justice really doesn't work for them. Now, there are a few paradoxes in there. There are organizations that because they provide direct services to women, they run clinics. So every time a woman comes to their clinic, she's not just coming needing to learn how to use birth control or seeking an abortion. But when she walks into that clinic, she's going to tell you about her bad housing or her lack of a living wage, which is why she can't pay the bill. They're the ones that are beginning to say, well, maybe there's something to this reproductive justice thing. Not because they understand it as a top-down thing, but because from their lived experience with real clients, it's beginning to make sense and how they need to package the services that they're delivering to people.
My understanding, you know, through the, you know, the history of women's movements in the U.S., you know, women's movements, mainstream ones, have been largely criticized for kind of excluding the voices of women of color. And I'm wondering if you can look at that exclusion within the context of reproductive justice.
Well, one of the things that both the mainstream women's movement, but let's also be clear, the coverage of the mainstream women's movement has done has marginalized the voices and perspectives of women of color. But I don't think it's intentional so much as it's tied to the different reproductive destinies of white women and women of color. Let me give you an example. A woman that I have much admiration for is Eleanor Smill, who is the president of NOW. I once had a conversation with Ellie. Ellie is married with two children. She and her husband, Charlie, had decided that they didn't want to have any more kids. So when Ellie went to her doctor for a voluntary hysterectomy, her doctor insisted that she get examined by two different psychiatrists to prove that she was not crazy for not wanting to have more children. On the other hand, I'm 19, I'm a black woman, I actually want 7 or 8 kids, and I'm sterilized. These are two different destinies imposed upon us by our white supremacist construct. So I tend not to be hypercritical of the mainstream white women for not understanding the perspective of women of color, because that's not the destiny that's intended for them. They're responding to the pressures that are put on them to have more children. But from the perspective of women of color, we're responding to the pressures to keep us from having a child. And so we have to fight for the right to have a child with the same determination that they fight for the right not to have a child. But I also made a point. There is the mainstream women's movement, but let's be clear, there were women of color in the mainstream women's movement, myself included. And so whenever we kind of repeat that, we've kind of like wiped out the history of all the women of color that were in the movement. But then there is the media and the public perception of the mainstream women's movement, which is always read as white and middle class. And to be honest, not all the white women in the movement were middle class. There were poor white women in the women's movement. There were rich white women in the women's movement. But they never say that. They never nuance it that way. There were poor black women in the women's movement, like myself. There were rich black women in the women's movement. They never talk about that. So we have to be clear not to respond to the media-dominated narrative of what the women's movement was, but talk about its reality. But I'm not surprised, and I don't offer critique. Now you ask me to relate that to reproductive rights. When Roe v. Wade legalized abortion in 1973, all of us saw that as a victory because women were dying in back alleys. Studies prove that 80% of the septic deaths from abortions were experienced by black and Puerto Rican women. So we knew that Roe v. Wade was going to save our lives. And so we established the legal right to abortion. 3 years later, Henry Hyde decided to put into place the Hyde Amendment, which restricted government funding for abortion. And this had the immediate impact of preventing women whose health care is provided by Medicaid to use Medicaid funds for abortion, women whose health care is provided by the Indian Health Service, women whose health care is provided because they're in the military, women in the Peace Corps. All these women were suddenly told that the government will no longer pay for abortion services. The critique that I offer of the mainstream movement, both its black and its white and its brown and its yellow components, is that we did not recognize Hyde as the onslaught of attacks that it really was. That if we allowed the government to take away abortion rights for poor women, that would start a slippery slope down which all our rights would slide. And that's exactly what has happened. At the same time, the way we framed support for abortion, I think, made us vulnerable to Hyde, because we said that abortion is a private decision between a woman and her doctor, and it's not the government's business to be involved in that private decision. That is true to a point. But then the government in Hyde turned around and said, well, it's a private decision, then the government doesn't have to pay for it. As a matter of fact, the government should not pay for the enabling of a private decision. And so we got hoist by our own petard, I guess that's the word, because after arguing that it was a privacy issue and not a sex discrimination issue, which is what I would have argued it, then we got told that the government doesn't pay for private decision. But even that's a canard, because every day, Americans make private decisions that the government pays for. I got to California because I privately decided to catch a plane. It's the government's job to make sure that plane stays in the air. It's the government's job to make sure I'm capable of enacting that private decision. And so to allow this separation between public and private is artificial. And I think that's one mistake that the women's movement made.
I wanted to also ask you, if you can talk about, you know, kind of the, we're talking about these experiences, if you can talk just a little bit more about this concept of reproductive justice within the framework of the government regulating reproductive choices and control of women's bodies, specifically within a historical context.
Well, I kind of have to climb back a couple of centuries, if you don't mind. But up until the 1800s, women generally made the decision on their reproduction. I mean, often men didn't even know we were pregnant till we told them. So we were the ones deciding whether or not we used birth control, whether or not we had an abortion. And there was the technology of the time that allowed us to do that. And then with the establishment of what's called modern medicine, the whole decision about what would happen to a woman's pregnancy was taken out of women's hands and midwives' hands and put into the medical establishment's hands. And I think we've been suffering from that ever since. I mean, look at doctors who are trying to force women to have cesarean sections who don't want them just because they earn more money from a C-section than a natural childbirth. I mean, it's so, all of our reproduction has been commodified now. And we no longer control that. So we've always have had to contest who controls our bodies and for what. Now, the development that we probably need to pay close attention to was at the end of the 1900s, there was a movement developed that was actually badly based on Darwin's science that was called eugenics, that began to promote positive breeding so that we could improve the race. And they meant the white race, by the way, because there were positive incentives that were created to encourage white couples to have more children. And then there were disincentives created including massive sterilization of people of color and anybody that they felt was unfit. 22 states passed eugenics laws that allowed the state to just sterilize anybody they wanted to that they deemed as not fit to reproduce. And so we have that history. Now, unfortunately, eugenics led to the Holocaust, because Nazi Germany seized the American movement of eugenics, by the way, and said, well, this makes sense to us. We don't think these Jews should be allowed to live in Europe, and so we're going to wipe out 6 million Jews. And as a matter of fact, the term genocide was created in 1943 by a Jewish lawyer who was describing the way Nazi Germany was forcibly sterilizing Jewish women, preventing Jewish people from accessing food, starvation policies. And a lot of people who think about the Holocaust forget that the Holocaust began with policies of starvation, sterilization, and exclusion long before we got to the gas chambers. And so the United States has had a very unhealthy belief in eugenics for the last century. Now, the Nazis discredited formally the science of eugenics so that the government could no longer openly say we're going to breed white people and not breed others. But then they've come up with different rationales that are eugenical in nature. In the 1950s, you had the government saying that the spread of communism was a threat to the world. And the reason communism was spreading so wide is because people in these countries were breeding too much and creating this youth bulge. That's when they created the first time that term youth bulge that they now use to describe the Middle East and so-called insurgents. They created that in the 1950s. The youth bulge is what's spreading communism around. Then by the 1960s and 70s, they started saying, oh my goodness, the environment is being destroyed by all this ceaseless breeding of people who are not responsible for the environment. They don't know how to protect their wetlands or their ancient forests, et cetera, et cetera. And so that became another eugenical rationale for controlling the population. Then with the riots of the 1960s in the inner cities of America, then they started blaming civil unrest that was usually caused by police brutality, by the way, on breeding, on the fact that these black communities and these brown communities were just having too many children and their children were getting into violence and gangs and riots. And so the Kerner Commission even recommended limiting the births in these populations. And now immigration is blamed. We're blamed for immigration. So eugenics as a pseudoscience has gone nowhere. It just keeps getting new spin every decade or so.
Stay tuned next week for part two of my interview with Sister Song Executive Director and Reproductive Justice Advocate Loretta Ross. For the Women's International News Gathering Service, I'm Sarah Olson.
Tune in next week for more of this interview. To hear Wings shows again, email wings@wings.org. Thanks to Wings supporters, including your community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the book Women and the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.